Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. I'm Alice Thwaite. This is the podcast where we talk about values. Specifically, we interview journalists, politicians, and academics about what they believe in, the idea being that we can then strengthen what our own core ideology is. So the Echo Chamber Club also produces a weekly newsletter where we curate articles that have an opposing argument to what is being said in liberal and progressive press. And that can be found on the Echo Chamber on echochamber.club. But this is the podcast where we talk more about what it means to be centrist, liberal, progressive, and try and define what that means for 2016 and 2017. So right now, I'm on a Skype call with an incredibly successful feature writer and journalist, Yoshi Herman. He's written for The Guardian, The Spectator, Newsweek, The Independent, The Standard, and now he's editor-in-chief at The Tab. And The Tab is incredibly influential. It's an online college news network with more than 100 branches in the US and the UK. So that's more than 100 universities across the US and the UK have a group of journalists who are writing for The Tab. It's pretty influential, as I said. To give full disclosure, though, Yoshi and I have known each other for quite a long time. So there might be a little bit of strong language in this interview, as we're quite relaxed with each other. But it should be a really interesting conversation, especially because we don't actually talk about this subject too much. And I'm pretty excited to find out what he's got to say about the beliefs of college students and just 18 to 25 year olds in the UK and the US. So welcome.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's a real pleasure. So should we start by talking about what you think, because you hang out with this group of people the whole time. What you believe the core values are of 18 to 25 year old university and college students in the Western world?
Certainly. So I've been involved with The Tab for a year now, just over a year. And that means that I edit stories, op-eds from college students in the UK and the US. But it also means I read a lot of what they're saying and speak to them when they're interning with us and that kind of thing. And it's a very interesting moment, I think, at the moment, particularly in the US, because college students have been the focus of a lot of attention from commentators who are on the right and some parts of the kind of mainstream as well, very concerned about the proliferation in their eyes of safe spaces and trigger warnings. And I think college students are also very interesting politically, in the sense that since the election of Donald Trump has been a renewed focus in the last couple of weeks on, is it on campuses where some of our problems are, or things that we've identified going wrong on campuses in terms of political discourse relevant to what's happening in America more generally, which as we'll come back to. If I had to define what our readers, which is college students, 18 to 22, it's also more widely slightly older graduates who read us after they leave university, particularly in the UK. So we've actually got more 18 to 25 or 28 demographic. If you looked at that group, I think when we were at Cambridge, which was, how long ago? It was 5 years ago. You would have said it was a very apolitical generation. I don't know if you would agree with that, but I specifically remember thinking, not necessarily disenfranchised from politics necessarily, but certainly not particularly engaged in it. And I remember, I did student journalism when I was at Cambridge, and I remember interviewing the head of the student Lib Dems, you know, and he was fairly exasperated that he had the unfortunate situation that he was part of a generation where his peers didn't really care about politics. And I thought that was generally the case. I wouldn't describe it necessarily as like totally nihilistic, but there was a lack of interest. And that's really different now. And I was struck by that when I joined the tab. I'd heard, you know, read and heard about some of the political issues on campuses in the UK, particularly related to gender identities, in the US related to race. When I joined the tab, I really realized that the current generation of undergrads, in general, to simplify things a lot, is much more engaged than our cohort was not so long ago. And they're engaged in a very, they're engaged in politics in a way that I think has a lot to do with solidarity. I think, generally speaking, you know, as you'd expect, elite college students in both countries are largely pretty liberal. There are some conservatives. But both the liberals and the conservatives on campus are very highly attuned to the issues facing people of colour, the issues facing trans students, the language that is required, you know, not to offend certain groups and to be accommodating to, you know, their peers. And the worst thing in their eyes would be to cause offence. And I think sometimes they kind of overcompensate a little bit. But that's a really interesting phenomenon. Liberal and conservative kids who are just much more highly attuned to the issues of trans rights and the situation facing people of colour in America in particular than kind of our peers were. And I would say whose politics in terms of ideology comes secondary to that. So I know some very conservative kids, including a friend of mine at Yale, and I know a lot of very, very liberal, super progressive, activist-y kids, including a friend of mine at Ohio State. Very different schools and very different perspectives, but all of them are sensitive, they're careful, and that is where I would say a lot of our readers are at. They're not exactly sure how to express their sympathy with marginalized groups or misunderstood groups on their campuses, but they really, really want to. And that, I think, leads to like a lot of good things, and I think it leads to some issues as well, which I wrote about in a piece for The Independent last year, which maybe we'll touch upon later. But does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, no, it's actually really interesting because a couple of things that have come up from doing this series already has been about the lack of labels, like the labels that we already have for kind of explaining what political ideology are simply isn't relevant now. So you talk about left wing, right wing, and you brought up liberal, conservative, and the fact that there's probably so much more that unites them today, but yet doesn't really have a label almost. I mean, people are using identity politics, but I'm not entirely sure if that corresponds with what you've just got at there. You've mentioned that they're potentially like politics in terms of ideology comes secondary to that, but that might be because there's not yet a label for that. Or do you think that simply the kind of the traditional battlegrounds of terms of liberty versus equality simply doesn't register as important with this age group? What's your opinions on that?
Yeah, I think the old labels still do apply in some kind of a way. I think because we've had a really strange election in the US, actually, some of the kind of flagship conservative issues like abortion and like free trade haven't, and small government, cutting the national debt, they haven't got a lot of airtime, actually. So it's quite difficult to know exactly where people are at on these traditional Republican issues. And it's quite difficult to know where people are at on the traditional Democrat issues like Social Security and healthcare.
Do you think that's because the people, so the voters, don't care about those issues? Or do you think it's because the media don't consider those issues to be important enough to give airtime?
I think it's because Donald Trump broke the rules on so many of them. Being anti-free trade, being pro, he says, Social Security, that we just didn't get these debates aired in the way we did in the past. However, I think you're probably onto something about labels and name tags, that there is a whole bunch of stuff going on in political discourse at the moment on campuses that doesn't have any very good labels. And I didn't mean to say that I think tolerance and being kind and not being a dick is a kind of ideology on the part of college students, but it's a priority for a lot of them. Bearing in mind that they're largely, you know, middle class, privileged East Coast or West Coast kids. But for those kids, and those are really the only people I can speak with any authority about, not being a dick, you know, basically being tolerant and showing solidarity with people who need it, is like a big thing. I don't know if your point about the ideologies giving way to kind of different alignments, which we don't have words for, I don't know how true that is, because we've had this weird election cycle where it's been quite difficult to test that hypothesis, I think. But I heard a really interesting point made on by Ezra Klein on his podcast, the Vox podcast. He had a long discussion with the Atlantic columnist, I think she's called Molly Ball. Yeah, Molly Ball. And he just said, certainly we don't have the words we require to talk about the demographic changes that have happened and the power changes that have resulted in America and how that makes, for example, white working class people feel. We have the word racist and bigot and deplorables in Hillary's words, but we don't have an amazingly precise vocabulary for talking about how those people feel. Now, I think some of that's also true with our conversation about people on campuses. We don't have a very good vocabulary, or we haven't come up with a set of words that are not dog whistles. So safe spaces and trigger warnings have become essentially dog whistles for kids are mental, the loony left, and free speech is also a bit clunky in this context, because I've come to believe that the issues that there are on US campuses are not really actually about free speech per se, or they're usually not. They're about something a little bit more subtle than that. I think that the issues that in discourse at the moment on US campuses are much more subtle and interesting than, on the one hand, free speech, and on the other hand, trigger warnings. Now, that may sound like a little bit hypocritical from someone who wrote a story a year ago for the Independent magazine that seemed to pit safe spaces against free speech, but that was kind of the subdeck of the piece, but that's not precisely what I think, which maybe we can get onto actually. But I think there's more interesting stuff going on there, and I think you're probably right that we don't quite have the right words for it.
Okay, cool. Well, shall we move on to kind of the events of 2016 and how that might have shaped people's opinions? So both in the UK and the US were, you know, two of the biggest political upsets in terms of no one really saw it coming. And you actually wrote something about the fact that you didn't see Brexit coming. And so everyone should be a bit more concerned about Donald Trump than they perhaps were. And then that prophecy was then correct. So let's talk about how you'd explain the attitudes of people towards, when I say to people, the demographic we're talking about, towards those two events, and also then what their reaction has been and potentially how their opinions have changed. What do you think about that?
I remember on election night, I called up my colleague, the US editor of the Tab, Matt McDonald. I called him up about 1:30 a.m. I think 2 a.m. or something. I'd just left a bar where I'd been interviewing a lot of Trump supporters in Manhattan. And he said, they're rioting in California. He meant the students in California, I think it might have been Berkeley, but certainly a couple of the UCs, they weren't exactly rioting, but they were on the streets and they were shouting "fuck Trump" and "not my president," and there was like this huge anger. And you know, it was happening on the West Coast because they, you know, they have a couple few hours spare on the East Coast, so that's it was kind of it must have been midnight for them or whatever. They were out protesting, and they were in shock, and they were angry, and it was the first kind of like visceral response you could see in America was these students who incredibly angry that he had been elected and were immediately disavowing him as their president. I can't speak for students across the US about what their reaction has been, but that set an early tone, I think. And it suggested that liberal students on campus in those places, it suggested to me a bit of an out of touchness, actually. And I say that as a kind of, you know, a lefty myself and and someone who wouldn't have voted for Donald Trump if I'd been had the ability to. But there's something about immediately saying that someone isn't your president and that sounded a bit more like it was about showing solidarity with your friends who felt really upset about this than it was kind of with engaging with the actual political reality. I think like there's a really interesting issue for progressives in the US and it same happened in the UK that they didn't see Trump coming, like liberals in kind of North London didn't see Brexit coming. And it really raises a super interesting question about whether that was an issue of empathy, whether these activists in New York, San Francisco, Philadelphia, London didn't care about the white working class communities in their countries who and how they were feeling, or whether they didn't know, you know, were they ignorant of it? Were they just not exposed to it, or were they not interested in it? Did they kind of know how a lot of people in their country felt, but think, fuck them, they're bigots, they're xenophobes, and the best thing is we don't need them anymore. We've got an electoral coalition without them. We've got an electoral coalition of, you know, Hispanic voters in the US, or we've got an electoral coalition in the UK, which doesn't require Bradford to be a solidly Labour Remain area. Like, I don't know which one of those two. I've been thinking about that a lot. And I think anyone who's in the media who thinks of themselves as liberal or progressive, including me, there needs to be self-examination about why they weren't capable of seeing this kind of thing coming. But a lot of questions, I think, or in particular, there are questions for people who call themselves liberal activists, because they, you know, advocate for equality and they advocate for harmony and they advocate for progress. And they either didn't see a huge part of the US not on board with them, or they saw it and didn't care. And I think one of those, both are damning. One's a bit more damning than the other. If I can actually add one little coda to that, since I wrote this Iceberg Campuses story a year ago, I think I largely kind of stand by the observations I made in that story, but I'm increasingly thinking about some of the issues about discourse on campus. I don't think, by the way, like a lot of people I think you speak to, maybe Claire Fox included, that campuses are in a disastrous situation. I don't think that there is some kind of like awful degenerating of discussion and debate. But I think there are a few issues about how students talk to each other and how willing they are to be open with each other. And I basically think that what's happening, or what seems to have happened, is that somewhere along the line, liberal and progressive kind of activists and students who consider themselves liberals and progressives have lost the art of persuasion, or they've stopped caring about persuasion as much as they care about showing solidarity. Some people on the right call showing solidarity virtue signaling, and I don't necessarily think that's always fair, but there's a lot of showing of solidarity and of saying the right things to one's peers. I don't think there's a lot of persuasion. And if you speak to kind of like veterans of the 60s anti-Vietnam movement, there's a writer called Todd Gitlin in the US who I spoke to about this. He is, for example, astonished that there is this such a sense of fragility and not really a sense of let's have it all out in a debate going on. And I basically think the problem there on campuses is it means that you're not persuading too many people. You're shaming people out of publicly expressing things that might be offensive, which is, you know, a good thing. You know, you don't want people to be offended in their day-to-day lives. But I don't think they're really persuading those people that what they believe is wrong and that they should change their mind, and that a simple switch in some ignorant belief they've got about the gender pay gap or some ignorant belief they've got about black-on-black crime, if they could just switch out of that, they'd actually be a lot more tolerant. I don't think there's a lot of that kind of persuading going on. And I think that's the real issue. I think solidarity is super important, but it's somewhere along the line the left has lost the ability to persuade. And by the way, I think that's the main parallel between campuses and between American politics more generally, that the same thing has happened, my crude understanding of what's going on suggests that the same thing might be happening, which is that liberals have decided, or people on the left or progressives have decided, that their key responsibility is not to persuade large swathes of their country that that being a progressive and believing in equality and believing in the intervention of government in markets and stuff is a good thing, but rather just to express their solidarity with minority groups and to live within their kind of bubble. And I know this bubble thing is a cliche, but really, like, there's been a lot of operating in bubbles going on. That's pretty clear. Okay. And there hasn't been a lot of persuasion, and there hasn't, I think, been a lot of going to the frontiers of your kind of genteel environment and wondering how people really think. I mean, I think the Brexit thing is an amazing example of that. I think there's a whole bunch of interesting questions about why people in London didn't understand the frustrations of people in the Northeast, which we could maybe talk about. I don't know. Anyway, I hope that kind of answers your question.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think that if we are, that's kind of a key ideology change, almost moving from solidarity through to persuasion. But how do you keep those key tenets of your philosophy, which is that trans people of color, presumably women is in there as well, these kind of key minority groups, how you make sure that they feel comfortable, well, as comfortable in the world as white men. But to ask a quick question about what you believe students are currently reading, so that potentially people can understand this group of people a little bit more. What papers are they reading, other than The Tab, of course? What podcasts are they listening to? Are there any particular books which are really taking off? What would you recommend people take a look at?
So I actually can't tell you exactly what they're all reading. I mean, like, there are sites that a lot of young people in the US read, like Mike, M-I-C, which are doing a lot of reporting on injustice in a broad sense, you know, racism, sexism, transphobia. And I wouldn't say a lot of college students that I know read Mike, but it is interesting that there is a big media company out there whose primary role seems to be reporting instances of injustice and commenting on them. So that's an interesting phenomenon. I'm not saying a lot of people are necessarily reading that I know. a book that I've been talking about with my friends a lot recently and that I'm recommending to people is actually a book I read a couple of years ago called The Unwinding by George Packer. He's a New Yorker writer. And The Unwinding is the best book I've read in terms of explaining what's going on in America. And I don't know if a lot of college students are reading it. I suspect a lot of them are. I'd recommend that everyone else does. What George Packer did was he kind of, I think it was published a few years ago actually, but he documented what he called the unwinding, the kind of the end of the Roosevelt kind of era in America, the closing of factories in the Midwest, the rise of kind of fast food chains and Walmart, the end of farming industry in some states and kind of furniture industries in other states. And he didn't make massive predictions about where everything was going to land, but now we know where everything's landed, or now we know what the upshot of some of the things that he was describing are. So I think looking back at his book, you know, which dealt with, you know, the housing crisis in Tampa and looked at the rise of Elizabeth Warren and looked at, you know, the kind of people in Silicon Valley and which looked at, you know, the Walmart family. I think that's a really interesting book. And I think it's the best manual I've seen to like kind of the new America. Anyway, yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks very much for coming on the Echo Chamber podcast, Yoshi.
Yeah. Thanks very much for having me. It's been great.
Enjoy your new year. So it was great to have Yoshi Herman chatting with us on Skype about college students, about how in previous years, perhaps college students were quite apolitical, whereas now they're starting to have a lot of different opinions, including solidarity. It might be worth hearing our subscriber's point of view when it comes to his point about empathy, or whether or not we just didn't know about reasons why you'd support Trump. So did we not care or did we not know? It would be really interesting to get your perspective on that, purely because I suppose the Echo Chamber exists because we believe that people didn't know. Very much looking forward to hearing your thoughts on that. And do tune in next time when we speak to Royfield Brown. Thanks for listening to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. I'm Alice Thwaite. This episode was produced by Rebecca Houston. Music by Emmanuel Dacer and Roof Now. Subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. Please find the rest of our content and contact details on echochamber.club.